strains.
Some want stronger antivirus enforcement, suggesting public apathy risks another COVID-induced economic downturn. People are required to wear masks on transit, but the government has said it will not implement lockdowns. People over 50 will be offered fourth vaccinations next week. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that 22% of people in the EU are struggling to make ends meet. That's almost 100 million citizens who are counting every cent. Apparently, sending weapons to Ukraine is not the answer.
The best way to deal with the cost of living crisis is to stop prolonging the war. The people of Europe favour peace, even well above punishing Russia.
EU financial markets are in turmoil. There are calls for the introduction of a windfall tax.
Energy prices and food prices are going through the roof. Capitalists make profits by speculating on markets and thereby hurting millions of households.
Members of the public have been talking to us about the current state of the EU's economy.
It's terrifying to see that our free market is like collapsing. All the money that we are going to send to Ukraine, then we will have to need this money, and where we are going to take this money from.
The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has been singled out for criticism in the European Parliament.
We talk now about the increase of cost of living in the European Union, which is just a result of the insane and unsound policies promoted by the European Union since Ursula von der Leyen took office.
There have been calls for greater solidarity between EU member states to deal with the cost of living crisis.
In order to make sure that we are not at the end dividing Europe in those who are able to help and those who have more difficulties.
On sanctions against Russia, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has said, quote, "Initially I thought that we had only shot ourselves in the foot, but now it is clear that the EU economy has shot itself in the lungs and is gasping for air." Many here agree. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Despite the UN-brokered truce, the consequences of the Saudi-led war are still taking the lives of Yemeni women and children. A recent report by the International Committee of the Red Cross says a mother and six newborns die every 2 hours in Yemen of complications that occur during pregnancy and causes that can be avoided in normal circumstances.
There is a severe shortage of medical supplies and medicines, as well as a significant increase in the prices of medicines, which has led to the deterioration of health services not only in the countryside, but even in main cities.
We as gynecologists have noticed a significant increase in the number of abortions, especially premature abortions in the early stages of pregnancy. Therefore, we hope to conduct studies that will reveal to us the reason and whether or not the prohibited weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition contributed to this tragedy.
The committee says the numbers are likely to increase due to a lack of health services or poor care provided, especially amid a shortage of funding for the United Nations programs in Yemen, as well as the termination of aid related to reproductive health and mother and child health. Recently, most of the United Nations programs, including the World Food Programme, announced the suspension of their humanitarian activities in Yemen due to a lack of funding, as well as the consequences of the Russia-Ukraine war.
Yemeni health officials say 19 million Yemenis lack access to health care. They say it is a shame for the international community to abandon Yemeni women and the children who have been paying the highest price since the beginning of the Saudi-led war in Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Yet another wave of COVID-19 is hitting South Korea, with cases doubling to 40,000 per day in the past week. The BA.5 Omicron subvariant accounts for almost a third of the new cases, a portion that is increasing. While experts recognize vaccines may not always prevent infection, they decrease illnesses and deaths.
Even people who have been infected with Omicron before are not able to develop enough immunity to this variant unless they are vaccinated. People who have been fully vaccinated and boosted but become infected have reduced chances of severe illness of 70 to 90%.
The fatality rate of COVID-19 has dropped to near the seasonal flu. Still, experts argue that changed behaviors of mask wearing and routine vaccinations should remain in place. The recent spike in COVID-19 cases here comes as South Korea Thursday detects the first case of BA2.75, nicknamed Centaurus. Scientists worry this highly mutated Omicron variant is even more transmissible than previous strains. Some want stronger antivirus enforcement, suggesting public apathy risks another COVID-induced economic downturn.
I know that more than 90% of corona can be prevented by wearing a mask, but if people keep coming inside and taking off their masks, I feel like it will be impossible to stop the spread. So the government should take stronger measures in that area.
People are required to wear masks on transit, but the government has said it will not implement lockdowns. People over 50 will be offered fourth vaccinations next week. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Every year in the lunar month of Dhul Hijjah, Muslims celebrate Eid al-Ghadir, a major festivity on the Islamic calendar, marking the day when Prophet Muhammad appointed Ali ibn Abi Talib, the first Shia imam, as his successor, and Muslims' next leader some 14 centuries ago. In Iran's city of Mashhad, the shrine of Imam Reza has been hosting pilgrims who have come days ahead of the auspicious occasion to celebrate the festivity.
Happy Eid al-Ghadir to all fellow Muslims. I come from Iraq to participate in the celebrations here in Mashhad.
Eid al-Ghadir marks the day when Prophet Muhammad announced to Muslims that Imam Ali is the next Muslim leader. He raised Imam Ali's hand and said, "Whoever I am their leader, Ali is their leader too." The Prophet was on his way back from his last Hajj pilgrimage, where he was accompanied by many people.
Eid al-Ghadir comes 8 days after another major festivity on the Islamic lunar calendar, dubbed Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice. The occasion marks the climax of the annual Hajj pilgrimage.
To us Iranians, it's a blessing to visit the shrine of Imam Reza on the Feast of Sacrifice and other festivities. Those of us who can't make it to Mecca on the Hajj usually come to Imam Reza's shrine to pray and enjoy the spiritual atmosphere.
Imam Reza is the eighth Shia imam, whose bloodline goes back to the Prophet of Islam. He holds a special position among Iranians since he spent his last years of life in Iran, away from his birthplace in modern-day Saudi Arabia. Every year, his holy shrine hosts millions of pilgrims from around the Muslim world, especially during religious occasions. Iranians never miss a chance to come and visit the shrine of Imam Reza. And now that Eid al-Ghadir is just around the corner, Shia Muslims find it an opportunity to once again attend this holy site and share the festive mood with each other. Yusuf Jalali from the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad.
Everyone is invited to this party that stretches for 10 kilometers in Tehran. As Shia Muslims around the world are marking Eid al-Ghadir, Iranians have got together in this festival to share the happy mood with each other.
This beautiful celebration has drawn many Iranians to enjoy Eid al-Ghadir festivity together. I congratulate all my fellow Muslims on the Eid.
Happy Eid al-Ghadir to all Muslims. We Shia Muslims regard this festivity as a chance to renew our allegiance with Imam Ali, our first Imam.
Eid al-Ghadir marks the beginning of Shia Islam some 14 centuries ago, when Prophet Muhammad appointed Ali ibn Abi Talib, the first Shia imam, as his successor and Muslims' next leader.
On Eid al-Ghadir, Prophet Muhammad raised Imam Ali's hand and said, "Whoever am their leader, Ali is their leader too." The Prophet was on his way back from his last Hajj pilgrimage, where he was accompanied by many people.
Imam Ali was the cousin of Prophet Muhammad and is known as the first man to embrace the Prophet's call for Islam. According to Islamic references, Imam Ali rooted out poverty and promoted an unprecedented justice system across the Muslim world during his short rule based in Iraq's city of Kufa.
Imam Ali represents justice, humanity, and chivalry. During his rule, he eliminated sexual and racial discrimination and promoted kindness.
Here, not only do Iranians celebrate Eid al-Ghadir, they get to teach their kids about who Imam Ali was.
I named my son after Imam Ali. It's not just about his name. I like him to act and behave like Imam Ali. That's why I brought him to this ceremony. Imam Ali is a role model for all of us.
In Shia Islam, there are 12 imams or religious leaders, all believed to have preserved the legacy of the Prophet. Mahdi is the last imam who is believed to be the apocalyptic savior of the world and is currently living in occultation. To Muslims, Eid al-Qadir is a time when God perfected their religion by introducing Imam Ali as their next leader. That's why they celebrate it every year to honor Imam Ali as the father of Shia Islam, a symbol of Islamic justice. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but thy generosity, and none supports but thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey thee. Worship by which I may deserve thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that thou makest me secure in the places of fear through thy security. And placest me in thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to special coverage on the Astana peace process over Syria. It was a big day here in Tehran, a pretty busy schedule for the Iranian government, also administration of President Raisi. They were hosting Turkish and, in order respectively, as they arrived, Turkish President, and also we had President Putin of Russia arriving here in the Iranian capital city, Tehran, for talks within the context of the what is called as the Astana peace process. The Astana peace process was initiated in 2017 in Kazakhstan, and we had three guarantors there, Turkey, Russia, Iran, and the aim is to come up with a solution to the Syria crisis. Now, in the last round of talks, discussions were held regarding the Syrian Constitutional Committee, refugee issue, humanitarian crisis, Turkish security concerns, U.S. forces presence, and the remaining pockets of terrorists. So those were the issues that discussed in previous rounds of negotiations, and also in this round of negotiations, the three presidents of Iran, Russia, and Turkey had their addresses, and they started that meeting, and they all emphasized respect for national sovereignty, territorial integrity of Syria, and President Raisi of Iran also highlighted the fact that extra-regional forces like the U.S. forces must leave the region and Syria. They are plundering Syrian oil, and we also have President Putin hoping that the three guarantors of the Astana peace process are trying their best, and they're trying to end international terrorism, including the one wreaking havoc in Syria, that they try to stabilize the situation there. They need to revive Syria's infrastructure and restore security there. Turkish president also said that Syria should be purged from all kinds of terrorists, and hopefully a political solution could be found. Now, to discuss this a little bit, I'm inviting a couple of guests. We'll have Mark Sloboda, international affairs and security analyst, who's joining me from Moscow, and also Elijah Magnier, journalist, simply analyst, in Marseille, France. Good to see you both, gentlemen. Let's start with Mark in Moscow. Well, I just gave you a gist of what's happening here in Tehran as we speak. The three leaders are discussing Syria. Let's begin with how significant this Astana peace process is. As President Putin of Turkey just claimed, that this is the only process that seriously is trying to deal with the issues besetting Syria.
Yeah, I would define the Astana peace process in a little more realist terms. I would define it as Russia and Iran managing their proxy war in Syria with Turkey, because that is has been the state of affairs since Russia's intervention in 2015 and for Iran even longer than that. They are on opposing sides in this conflict, and the Erdogan regime, it continues to occupy large swaths of northern Syria and is ethnically cleansing the territory and continues to support Al-Qaeda, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, by whatever support it is now. Russia and Iran have managed to weed out all of the other Gulf players through this management of the process with Turkey. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the United Emirates, they all dropped out of the game, as it were. And right now, it is essentially a Mexican standoff that has been the status quo in the country for years now, with very little changes. And that is the Syrian government, supported by Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah, the Turkish regime, with its use of Al-Qaeda, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, and other Islamists and jihadists as proxies, and the United States militarily occupying East Syria through its use of the Syrian YPG as their proxy forces. And that standoff continues to this day. And right now, this latest rounds of negotiations were simply Russia and Iran warning Erdogan not to launch another incursion to siege more territory in northern Syria.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Elijah, we had President Raisi of Iran saying that the fate of Syria must be determined by the Syrian people themselves, and also Syria negotiations. The Astana Peace Press also trying to do the same. They bring together representatives from the opposition and also the Syrian central government. But let's speak a little about that.
Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I agree that the main talk was about Syria. However, there are many other important talks during this three president summit in Tehran. But if that you want to talk about Syria, I think the problem there is Russia cannot stand against Turkey on its own because of the war in Ukraine, because Russia needs allies, and Turkey is not an enemy at the time being. And Russia would do very well with the support of Iran, because they both have the same objective, to stop President Erdogan from taking a security zone, as he calls it, of 30 kilometers and occupying further land than Idlib and the northwest Syria. This is something that the Russian, the Iranian, and the Damascus agree, and because Erdogan imposed himself as a very important player in Syria, they need to talk with him about it, at least to block him. I am not very optimistic about what's going to happen, because as long as President Erdogan is in power, at least for mid next year, he's not going to give up on Idlib. But I think what the Russian and Iranians are trying to do is to make sure that he's not going to push his forces in the north east Syria, which are also the Americans present there occupying their part of the country. And they also disagree with President Erdogan's plans, because they are the one who are protecting the YPG and the Syrian version of the PKK. So in that regard, I think the Iranian, what they are trying to do in this summit, and they have succeeded in a way, is to make sure that President Erdogan looks at the economic benefit that he's getting from his alliance with Iran and with Russia, particularly that is related to the oil and gas, where both countries that are oil and gas producers are going to give Turkey the energy that he needs, and perhaps he will be the channel that will pass it on to the Europeans And then President Erdogan will weigh the benefit and the damages that he can create in this alliance with Russia and Iran if he moves forward into the Syrian territory. However, we heard the Iranians and we heard the Russians saying that the integrity of Syria is very important and that they are willing to work all together, including President Bashar al-Assad, to work then against the terrorists, whoever they are, because they were not very defined in this conversation, in this summit, for a particular reason, because it is not meant to go into small details. That's why reviving Astana and introducing the fact that it's important to go to a new constitution, all these elements, I think people remain on their position, but the aim now is to calm down the game in Syria.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mark, let's now take a look at the stabilizing or destabilizing roles that players are actually international players, are what they are doing in this region. The U.S. president the other day was talking about what he called Iran's destabilizing role in this region, but I wonder what he's talking about. I mean, if you remember, Iran, General Soleimani helped Iraqis on the request of the Iraqi government to help the nation and government to get rid of Daesh, and he made a great contribution, as you know. Iran is holding this Astana peace process in order to try to bring peace and tranquility back to Syria, getting the opposition representatives and the government to sit at the table and try to address their issues. Iran also offered the Hormuz Peace Initiative during the previous administration, in which it offered Persian Gulf littoral states to again get around the negotiating table and discuss any issues and any points of concerns that they have. So what now, let's compare and to see what actions the U.S. has taken in this region and what Iran is doing. Who's playing a destabilizing role?
Yeah, I mean, of course, who is destabilizing is in the eye of the beholder. The U.S. imagines itself as the hegemonic power in the Middle East, you know, from the other side of the world. And it manages its hegemony in the Middle East through a tripod relationship with Saudi Arabia and Israel, and is constantly working to improve the ties between the two of them. So it is at least something more than a hub and spoke type relationship. And when the U.S. government talks about Iran's destabilizing interests, they mean that it is undermining its hegemony of the region, of the region. And in particular, they're referring to Iran's long principled support of Palestine and their opposition to the Israeli military occupation and slow ethnic cleansing of Palestine. As well, of course, as their own local geopolitical rival with the Saudi dictatorship. So that is what is meant by the term destabilizing, even though the U.S., of course, tries to paint themselves as the good guys and Iran as the bad guys in simplistic Manichaean terms.
Okay, yeah, but Elijah, when you look at what the U.S. has done in this part of the world, the first question is, as Iran is always insisting, that regional states can resolve their regional problems on their own. They don't need any extra-regional power. And given what the U.S. has done in Iraq, in Afghanistan, its proxy war in Yemen, helping the Saudis, and you name it, you know, China and others and Russia, actually the Ukraine thing. So how could you, I mean, this, you cannot square this off with what they're talking about. In the first place, what's the U.S. doing in this part of the world? And is it trying to stabilize this region or destabilize it and set this country off against the other country in order to sell, you know, its arms and weaponry and make big bucks?
Well, since 1991, I remember when I was covering the war in Kuwait, the Americans destroyed the infrastructure in Kuwait while Saddam Hussein was withdrawing, and with the aim to rebuild Kuwait and make space for the American companies. In whatever the Americans are doing, starting from demonizing Iran, is to make sure they sell weapons to the Gulf countries, make sure that they separate Iran from the Gulf country, create a havoc in the region, because divide and rule, that is the principle of the Americans, who have no morale in human rights or politics or in their objectives, not only in the Middle East, but also in other parts, in Asia and in Latin America and in Africa, everywhere. What they have done in Iraq is the best example. What they have done in Syria, President Donald Trump had no shame in saying, I want the oil. We had four-star U.S. generals who saying, have we become pirate? So this is what the Americans is about. By imposing sanctions on Syria, imposing the Caesar Act, preventing Jordan from opening the border for many years, occupying Al-Tanf, the border between Iraq and Syria, is to cripple the Syrian economy, preventing the Gulf country to return to Syria to invest in the reconstruction, is to really break the back of the population. Imposing sanctions on Iran since 1979 under President Jimmy Carter until President Biden today, who continue increasing the sanction, is again to turn the population against their ruler. All these objectives in Lebanon, in Palestine, they are very strong and powerful example of what the U.S. Has been doing in the region to make sure that the region is weak. It's a burned territory. However, we see that this is not going to last forever, because we start seeing very clear indication from countries in the region to meet together, meeting in different parts. Now the Americans are out of the negotiation between Saudis and the Iranians, and the Iranians and the Egyptians and the Jordanians. All that is happening in an Arab Islamic country that is in Iraq. That these are very good signs and strong messages sent to the Americans that we can solve our problem without you, and you better stay away. And that was again reconfirmed during the last meeting and the summit of President Biden in Jeddah, where the language of the Saudis and the Gulf country was positive. It was not demonizing Iran as usual. It was saying extending peace to Iran and saying exactly what the Iranians have been saying: we want to talk together, we want peace, we want to sort out our differences. Now I think the world is shifting.
Now, Mark, another topic that was highlighted in this Astana negotiations especially just a few hours ago is trying to fight terrorism, and especially terrorism in the region and also including Syria that's located in this region. So, is this, when you look at it from another perspective, that's how the previous U.S. administration, maybe this one also, was looking. They tried to divide the terrorists into different groups, the good ones and bad ones, and then they, once they supported this group of terrorists, the other day they say these are not good terrorists, and they change the location. So what is it that they are planning to do? I mean, what's the right way, what's the right course to actually fight and purge terrorism from this region?
Yeah, I mean, the same problem is highlighted in the limitations of the Astana.
Well, we just lost that connection. Elijah, go ahead if you heard my question with the answer.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
In a nutshell, I was asking the right path to fight international terrorism in this region.
Well, international terrorism was the main job, for example, in Syria, of the Syrian government and the Syrian army. They are the one who fought terrorism in Syria in collaboration and the support of their allies. Haji Shabi is the one who fought terrorism in Iraq, and not the Americans. They are the one with the Iranian and other allies who stood against the extension of Daesh power that the Americans watched during Barack Obama without moving. And all this terrorism that has been supported by the Americans in the region is to create a sectarian war among Muslims in the Islamic world, to find another way to cripple the economy of the Middle East, to make it engage internally against one another. All that is now over, because the population in the countries like in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen stood against the terrorists, and they fought against the terrorists, and this is a card that is no longer valid today. Now, if you look at the region in Syria, in the north, west, and east of Syria, we see the Americans in good terms with Abu Muhammad al-Julani, who is the ex-emir of Daesh and ex-emir of Al-Qaeda. And we see on the other side, in the east, they are the ones who are protecting what President Erdogan is saying, the Kurdish terrorists that are the PKK branch, the Syrian branch. So we always see the hand of the Americans in every single support to terrorists in the Middle East, West Asia.
Okay, looks like we have a connection with Mark. Mark, sorry about that technical hitch. Go ahead with your comments.
Yeah, I what we see with the problem with the limitations of the Astana process is the same problems that you see at the United Nations when discussing the topic of terrorism. The problems with defining it and the problems with deciding who the terrorists are, because everyone thinks they're someone different. And the Astana process has achieved a lot, but it's really reached its limitations. Because when Russia and Iran and the Syrian government are talking about terrorists, they're principally talking about Al-Qaeda, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, and the 31 flavors of jihad that have long been the proxies of Turkey and previously the United States and the Gulf Cooperation Council countries in Syria. Meanwhile, when Turkey is talking about terrorists, it's not talking about Al-Qaeda. It does not view them as terrorists. I mean, officially they do, but in reality, they are, of course, arming, funding, and supporting them, cooperating with them. They have for years. They're talking about the YPG and the PKK, and right. It has to be said that Russia does not recognize those groups as terrorists. So in order to avoid a complete breakdown of the Astana process, which the three countries still find useful to a degree for managing their proxy war in Syria, it has kept the conflict effectively frozen for a time. They refer to terrorism without defining who the terrorists are. Turkey's talking about the YPG, the PKK, and Russia, Iran, and Syria, whom they represent, are talking about Turkey's proxies.
Okay. And Elijah, President Putin said that the U.S. agenda for Syria is to plunder its resources. That's happening, and we hear reports just a few days ago, and also disintegrating Syria. Do you share the same view?
I do, actually, because the 23% to 25% of the Syrian territory that is under the U.S. occupation is the basket of food for the Syrian population and the basket of energy, the source of energy for Syria. And now today, Syria is relying on the support of Iran and Russia to receive the wheat and the food and the oil that is needed, because the Americans not only have imposed sanctions on Syria that are very harsh and very powerful, but they are stealing the oil and transporting it from Syria to Iraq, and then they are selling it, and they are using it, they're giving it to Turkey, and they exchange it to oil that they take back home. So all that, and preventing the Syrians from recovering their territory, which the Syrian army is very capable of to do today, it's also a way for the Americans that they have no policy, no strategy in Syria today under Joe Biden, is to keep their forces in Syria and to make sure that they cripple the Syrian economy. Now, we also see that their position in Iraq is also complementary to their position in Syria, because the Iraqis will kick them out sooner or later. So they consider that their presence in their area, where they offer support also to the Israelis who are bombing Syria on a regular basis, and the Israelis are using the military air bases and airports that are under the U.S. occupation in the northeast Syria. All these elements represent the policy of the U.S. to really break the Syrian country and the Syrian population, and to make sure they don't recover very quickly.
Okay, that's all the time we have for this special coverage on the Astana peace process and Syria. Let me thank our guests, Mark Sloboda in Moscow, and Elijah Magner in Marseille, France.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
They are counting on that small investment in anti-tax Republicans to save them billions in taxes, said Americans for Tax Fairness, which conducted the analysis. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kenny Stencil, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Just 27 billionaires have spent $90 million to buy GOP Congress, a report shows. Here's the story. A few dozen billionaires are spending tens of millions of dollars on the 2022 midterm elections, mostly to support Republican candidates, including many who have parroted the dangerous lie that the 2020 presidential election was stolen, in a bid to ensure that Congress is full of lawmakers willing to make their wealthy benefactors even richer, according to a fresh analysis. Titled Billionaires Buying Elections, the report from Americans for Tax Fairness, ATF, details how billionaires are increasingly using their personal fortunes and the profits of connected corporations to drown out regular voters' voices and elect hand-picked candidates who further rig the nation's economy, especially the tax system. A pair of super PACs tasked with securing Republican majorities in the House and Senate, the Congressional Leadership Fund, CLF, and the Senate Leadership Fund, SLF, raised a combined $188.3 million through the first 16 months of the 2022 campaign cycle, according to ATF. Nearly half,
$89.4 million, or 48%, came from just 27 billionaires. A whopping 86% of the GOP's billionaire money came from Wall Street tycoons, who are arguably the biggest beneficiaries of glaring loopholes in the tax code. The Democratic counterparts of those two super PACs, the House Majority PAC and the Senate Majority PAC, raised a combined $154 million over the same time period. Smaller share, $25.8 million, or 17%, came from 19 billionaires. A majority of billionaire contributions to Democratic candidates also came from the finance and investment sector, about 35%, but other industries were also well represented, including cryptocurrency, 26%, and tech, 18%. Unlike candidates and party committees, super PACs can raise unlimited donations from individuals and corporations, ATF explained. In return, they are not supposed to coordinate activities with the campaigns they support, but instead act independently, though that rule is often flouted. Top billionaire donors to congressional super PACs include hedge fund magnate Ken Griffin, who has given more than $28.5 million to CLF and SLF, and private equity mogul Stephen Schwarzman, who has pumped $20 million into GOP's super PACs. Anti-democratic vote-buying ATF road has been facilitated by and is facilitating the accelerating wealth growth of the billionaire class and the record profits of the corporations they won. The combined net worth of the nation's roughly 750 billionaires surged by $2 trillion, or 70%, during the first 2 years of the COVID-19 pandemic. The collective wealth of the 27 billionaires bankrolling the GOP super PACs alone soared by $82.4 billion over that time period, meaning that the $89.4 million they have donated to CLF and SLF constitutes less than 0.1% of their overall pandemic-era gains. Meanwhile, the return on that modest investment could amount to billions of dollars if Republicans take back Congress in November and preserve their 2017 tax cuts or further slash taxes on super-rich people and the corporations they won. Over a recent 9-year period, the 400 wealthiest people in the U.S. paid an average effective federal income tax rate of just 8.2% when the increased value of their stock holdings is included in their income. That is a lower rate than the nationwide average of 13.3% in 2019. As ATF explained, focusing on contributions to congressional super PACs fails to capture the full political influence of billionaires who, in addition to personal donations, also steer money to favored candidates from related corporations and organizations. Billionaires are among the ultra-wealthy Americans who control corporations through their extensive stock holdings. Many corporate giants have been distorting the upcoming midterms, ATF pointed out, by spending tens of millions to help GOP candidates who have vowed to defend the special tax breaks for the top 1% get elected, including 144 far-right members of Congress who voted to overturn President Biden's electoral victory. According to the report, seven powerful corporations, including AT&T, Chevron, ExxonMobil, FedEx, GM, Merck, and Ops, have collectively given nearly $1.5 million to dozens of election deniers and various Republican PACs and election committees this campaign cycle. The companies demonstrated lack of concern for democracy, ATF noted, likely stems from their desire to keep dodging taxes. In 2021, these firms paid an average federal income tax rate of just 2.7% on a combined $78.4 billion in profits. Notably, Peter Thiel, the co-founder of PayPal, who is worth about $5 billion and openly opposed to democracy, has been spending big on his preferred Republican candidates, but not through the GOP's congressional super PACs. Thiel has so far spent almost $30 million through super PACs, supporting the 2022 senatorial bids of two firms. And employees who share his anti-democratic and anti-tax beliefs, ATF found, adding, J.D. Vance won the Ohio Republican U.S. Senate primary thanks in part to Thiel's $15 million in spending. Blake Masters has a fighting chance in Arizona's GOP U.S. Senate primary in August due to Thiel's $13.5 million in contributions. Another source of billionaire dominance of campaign financing, especially on the Republican side, wrote ATF, are so-called dark money groups, which are not required to disclose the identity of their donors. Some dark money groups, including Club for Growth, which has received $32 million from billionaire Wall Street trader Jeffrey Yes over the years, are notorious for having bankrolled insurrectionist members of Congress like Senator Josh Hawley and Lauren Boebert, ATF noted. According to the report, politically active billionaire Charles Koch has personally donated to either GOP Super PAC this cycle, but his corporation Koch Industries has so far given them a total of $1.75 million. Two of the biggest dark money groups, which do not disclose their donors, are essentially sister groups to the two congressional GOP Super PACs. American Action Network gave at least $26 million to CLF in the 2020 cycle and $18.7 million so far this cycle. One Nation donated $77.5 million to SLF last cycle and has given $16.5 million so far this cycle. The ability of the nation's wealthiest individuals to translate their disproportionate economic power into political clout has increased exponentially since the U.S. Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision eliminated effective limits on campaign contributions. According to the report, billionaires pumped $1.2 billion into the 2020 elections, almost 40 times more than the $31 million they donated in 2010, when the Citizens United rules were first in effect. In the 2020 election cycle, billionaires contributed nearly $1 out of every $10, while making up just 0.1% of all donors contributing more than $200. Billionaires donated almost $240 million to the combined campaign efforts of Donald Trump's two runs for president. Over half came from just one billionaire household, that of magnate Sheldon Adelson, who has since died. Billionaires who are used to buying whatever they want have increasingly dedicated their almost unlimited resources to buying American elections, Frank Clement, executive director of ATF, said in a statement. The problem is what's good for billionaires, including cutting taxes on the rich and corporations, is bad for working families, said Clement. We need to rein in billionaire political and economic power through campaign finance reforms and tax reforms, such as a billionaire's income tax, several legislative proposals have emerged to tax the increased value of assets owned by the nation's wealthiest households each year, regardless of whether they sell or keep them, which would ensure that income derived from wealth is taxed more like income earned from work. Biden's plan would raise an estimated $360 billion over 10 years, while Senator Ron Wyden's plan would raise an estimated $550 billion over a decade, and Representative Jamal Bowman's proposal possibly even more. Billionaire-backed Democratic Senator Joe Manchin, however, has joined Senate Republicans in opposing such a measure.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.